Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website, which is www.theorganicview.com. If you have any questions or would like to connect with us, you can simply post a question on our wall on Facebook, send us a tweet to @TheOrganicView, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's show is sponsored by Eden Foods, one of the most trusted names in certified organic clean foods. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive 20% off any regularly priced items, excluding cases. Simply enter the coupon code ORGVIEW when prompted during checkout. That's ORGVIEW. For more special offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. Recently, I hosted a discussion with bee experts Walter Hofiger and Randy Oliver about the impact of neonicotinoids on bee health. Due to the overwhelming response for more information, we will continue to explore this subject today with world-renowned toxicologist Dr. Henk Tanakies and bee advocate Tom Theobald to continue this discussion. This is the second of a three-part series in which we will review some of the common beliefs as stated in the Oliver-Hofiger discussion. For those of you that missed the live show, please visit theorganicview.com, which is the only place where you can actually listen to the entire show. The second issue that we will explore involves the partial ban on neonicotinoids in Europe. It was suggested that the United States should follow the European lead on partially banning neonicotinoids. Is this something the EPA should do? Let's talk about it with two other experts. So I would first like to welcome to the show Dr. Henk Tanakies. Good afternoon, Dr. Tanakies, and welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, June.
And I would also like to welcome to the show Mr. Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom, and welcome back.
Hello, June. Hello, Henk. It's good to meet again.
Hello, Tom.
So it's great to have you both. Now, for our listeners, I want to explain exactly what's going to happen today. Recently, I conducted an interview with two respected bee experts about neonicotinoids and global bee losses. I hosted a show in which Mr. Randy Oliver, who is a biologist and owner of scientificbeekeeping.com, and Mr. Walter Hofiger, who's president of the European Professional Beekeepers Association and member of the board of directors for the German Professional Beekeepers Association and the coordinator of the Appamondia Working Group on GMOs, participated in a discussion presenting at times opposite views but also shared some of the same views. So today, we're basically going to revisit that interview. Dr. Tanakies will be commenting, as well as Tom Theobald, as far as both participants' responses. So first, I would just like to take a moment to thank Dr. Tanakies. Thank you for coming on the show today. I know that it's the evening where you're at, so thank you for taking the time. Oh, it's always great to have you on. And also, Tom Theobald, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, June.
Now, I'm going to begin by airing a clip, which question and their responses, and then the response will begin with Henk and then followed by Tom's response.
So here are the final two questions that were asked of our previous panel.
Do you think independent research should be used to determine neonicotinoid policy?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is right now. That's the main basis of independent research. I mean, the registrant does a small amount of research initially, but then in order to separate them from the research, they subcontract it out to independent researchers, and that research is all studied by the regulators, the EPA and PMRA and EFSA. In addition, then universities also conduct independent research, and if they follow, you know, good scientific methods, that all that research is utilized. When I sit and I talk with PMRA regulators, and I've spoken at great length with the EPA regulators, they're very much aware of this, of all the independent research. And then when you look at their their analyses, the risk analyses, risk assessments, of these pesticides, they go over every one of those bits of independent research, and they rate it as to how scientifically valid it was, whether there were deficiencies in that research, whether it's utilizable, and then they decide what they can use out of it. But I can guarantee you, they're very much aware of every bit of independent research, as well as anecdotal evidence. And the anecdotal evidence may not be able to be used strongly in the decision, but it's certainly they're very much aware of it, and it helps to influence their decision. So the EPA, like I said, the EPA at the last national convention for beekeepers in the U.S., they had 5 representatives there, and we all spoke, and we had dinner at the table with the leading pesticide researchers, independent ones from Penn State University. They spoke with all the beekeepers. They're very much aware of what's happening, so they're as much interested in the beekeeper experience, anecdotal evidence, with independent research. I think it's a misconception that they go strictly by the research conducted by the registrant themselves.
Thank you. And Walter, do you think independent research should be used to determine neonicotinoid policy?
Of course, independent research should be used. When there's a lot of money involved in a product, independent research, truly independent research, sometimes is hard to come by. Anecdotal evidence plays a role as well. Just to recap how this everything played out in Europe, we started out with an approval process with required tests that were conducted by the manufacturers, and these required tests essentially said there was an acceptable risk for bees, so the products were approved. Then the beekeepers observed in the field all kinds of problems that were not consistent with what came out of the approval process, and managed to get a few independent scientists involved in confirming what they saw. The first scientists that started to look into the risks of neonicotinoids independently were heavily attacked, and only over time there was kind of safety in numbers, where more and more additional scientists started to confirm this research. The first response by industry was, well, beekeepers may observe things in the field, but what they're observing is not scientifically valid. It's not a controlled study. It's just anecdotal. So the industry asked for repeatable studies in the lab. Then years went by with all these lab studies being conducted, and these lab studies, that's a major reason why Europe eventually opted for this partial ban. The lab studies showed that there were all kinds of effects on bees that the original registration process hasn't picked up on. So now that we have lab confirmation of these effects, the position of industry is, but what about the field relevance? We need field studies now. Well, that is exactly the point where we started. So from the beekeeper's perspective, we feel that we're really getting the runaround here, and we're glad that the regulators in Europe and the Commission and the member states are basically stopped buying into this runaround.
Thank you. Randy, would you like to comment?
Yeah, you know, I hate to put, you know, some of the judgmental opinions on this.
Mm-hmm.
What you realize, you have this, our farmers are going to use insecticides. I mean, I've been involved in the organic farming movement for like 35 years, and in 35 years, we've captured 1% of U.S. farmland. So, I mean, we've been and successful. Now, we can return to this later, how we could be more successful at reducing pesticide use throughout agriculture. But the farmers are going to use something right now. Right now, you know, if you're Joe Farmer and your crop's going to be eaten by insects, you're going to use something. You're going to use hopefully something illegal, but you're going to use something. So the question always is what do we want them to use? I mean, is something there's many of the older are available other alternative pesticides, insecticides to the neonics. We know are demonstrably harmful. They just you know kill every insect in the field, and they have huge effects on the birds and other wildlife. So if we yank the neonics, the question always is, will we go back to this? Now, the actual beekeepers in the middle of the U.S. Corn Belt tell me over and over again, Randy, it's the best it's been. We no longer have the kind of pesticide kills that we used to see. We no longer see the dead birds in the field afterwards. So, I'm not a booster for neonics in any way. But my fear is, if they are banned, then what are the farmers going to use in their place? And this is that's that law of unintended consequences. So we have to be very careful when you do a blanket ban. And this will be interesting for us to see in Europe what's going to happen. Now, the Europeans, beekeepers, hope that the bees are all going to recover and all become healthy when the neonics are no longer used there. From my experience and from me looking at on-the-ground evidence, scientific evidence, I suspect that may not happen. I think I know very well, there's a lot of, as Walter knows, there's a lot of other issues going on with bees these days, especially since the invasion of the varroa mite and of Nosema serrani. So a lot of the things that get blamed on insecticides may not actually be due to insecticides. So yesterday I was out in one of my bee yards, and here was a colony of bees with just dead, twitching bees in front of the entrance. When I tipped the hive up on the bottom board, there were about 1,000 dying, twitching bees. And, man, if you got a video camera, it would just look just like a pesticide kill. But I'm in a totally organic area, and it's been snowing up here. So there have been no insecticides sprayed up here all season. And the bees are suffering from an epidemic of chronic paralysis virus, which is a natural bee virus. But if a beekeeper looked at it, they would have probably said, hey, man, that was just a pesticide kill right there. So the question is, you know, beekeepers are always properly diagnosing what the problems are that are happening in their hives. It's very convenient to blame them on one thing or another, but when I actually look at the evidence, I often find that the beekeepers have misdiagnosed what the problem is.
Walter, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah. You know, Randy, the EU-wide ban, we don't know what is going to happen as a consequence, but the EU-wide ban and the whole process, as I mentioned before, was initiated because some member states instituted bans, regional bans, or as early as 2008. Mm-hmm. And what is very interesting is the same claims were made that the farmers will have to switch to other pesticides, that there will not be a recovery of the bee population because there are other issues that mm-hmm. beekeepers are facing with. And in Italy, the government was smart enough to actually institute a scientific process to monitor the results of the ban. And what happened was that, both the numbers for Italy and Germany show that, corn production went actually up after the ban. The claims of industry that their products were absolutely essential for the farmers and the production would collapse did not happen at all. And the recovery of the bee population actually happened. So this was actually one of the key factors in the scientific process that EFSA looked at. They looked at what happened in the areas where the partial bans were instituted. And to some extent, with the push for these partial bans, the beekeepers actually saved the farmers money. It is also important to understand that the alternative to using an insecticide is not necessarily using another insecticide. The emphasis that was then put on to respond to the lack of availability of the neonicotinoids was the use of more use of crop rotation and other farming methods. Finally, the switch to other pesticides, maybe earlier generation pesticides, is also not quite as obviously bad as you suggest, Randy, because the neonicotinoids are used as systemic pesticides, so they're, the seed is being treated whether there is a pest or not. Mm-hmm. And once you've used the product, it basically is something that the environment has to deal with for the whole year. If you are using spray applications, you can use integrated pest management and take a look at whether the pest is there at all. And for example, if the pest isn't there, not use any pesticide. You can also stick to the regulations for spray applications and spray outside of the foraging times of the bees. So sometimes the spray applications, if they're used as indicated by the approval process, can be better than seed treatment with neonicotinoids. What you also need to understand is that the theory that they had when they originally approved neonicotinoids was that, well, we know it's acutely toxic to bees if they come in contact with them, but we're using it as a seed treatment and we're burying it in the ground. The problem with that is it turns out that there are all kinds of exposure routes for bees that they didn't think of. The dust problem was only one of these issues. A certain percentage of the seed never makes it into the ground. It ends up in puddles, turning the surface water highly toxic. Again, one of the reasons the EFSA conclusions came out the way they did was a study of surface water in the Netherlands that basically shows a high level of contamination of surface water. They didn't think of gotation in the approval process, and the EU is not just instituting these partial bans, but the EU is in the process of revamping the whole approval process so that the tests to assess the risks properly are more appropriate to the generation of pesticide being tested.
Randy, would you like to respond?
Well, I agree with Walter on almost every point.
All right, good.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
I mean, obviously, the seed treatment with neonicotinoids is totally contrary to integrated pest management, that
mm-hmm.
you're putting something on before you ever see a pest. There's also
mm-hmm.
really good evidence in the U.S. that it's unnecessary for
yep.
if the farmers are planting BT, genetically engineered corn, that there's very little benefit in most cases of using a neonicotinoid seed treatment to corn. But this is a different question.
I need
question.
To do a quick response to that later.
Okay. It's
All
a different right. question than your question.
Mm-hmm.
One is whether something is actually of benefit to the farmers. That's a business decision. That's an individual decision for them, as opposed to a regulatory decision. So is the regulatory decision to tell farmers how to grow their crop and what business decisions to make, or is it? Are we basing your original question was on science, so I think we got kind of sidetracked there on whether there's going to be a decrease in corn production. No, I don't think there'll be a decrease in corn production. You know, of course, the industry is going to come back and say that, but that's just part of the game that's played. So I have to ask you, what are your questions here? If you're asking whether we should follow the European ban, that's one question. Whether you're asking, are neonicotinoids being used to the highest and best use right now? That's an entirely different question. That's pretty much what Walter was going on in there, and in which I'm totally in agreement with him on most of those points. But again, we get down to the bottom line is, if you go to the most intense area of neonicotinoid use in the entire United States, that is the Corn Belt of the United States, where it's in the state of Iowa, 2 out of every 3 square feet of land are planted in either corn or soybeans. Most of those are seed treated with neonicotinoids, and the beekeepers are thriving there. They tell me there's no problem. It's the best it's been. So yes, theoretically there could be all kinds of problems. In reality-wise, we're just not seeing that. So again, if you say should there be a ban, well, should there be a ban if we're not seeing an actual on-the-ground problems? Now, pesticides in general need to be much better regulated. And as Walter says, the new regulations coming in, the new assessment processes are much better. They look at the other exposures, and I'm happy to see them do this. Now, one thing you might want to be aware of is that chemical companies are very much on board with this, and because they, when they're developing something, they only want to have one set of conditions to meet for registration. So if they can have PMRA, EFSA, and EPA all agree on what they want, then it's better for them. And this is something that may surprise some of the listeners, and it surprised me because I've come into contact with lots of people from the industries, and it's really easy to put horns on their heads and to demonize them. But when I actually and I've dealt with salesmen. I would never trust a pesticide salesman. Their job description is to sell pesticides. That's their job. So of course they're going to sell pesticides. So you have to take anything they say with a grain of salt. But when I speak with the scientists who are actually developing the newer classes of pesticides, to a person, these people are concerned about the environment. They have families. They want to do the right thing. They're trying to come up better with more environmentally safe products. And we have to give them credit for that rather than simply demonizing them, because the farming industry is going to call for pesticides for the foreseeable future. And I would love to have a day when we never have to use any kind of synthetic pesticide, but I doubt if I'll live to see that day. So in the interim, we have to live in the real world. And this is the important thing to me is how we work with both the agriculture industry and the chemical industry, and the two of them are very closely related, and how we play fair on this. So when, again, we go back to what's your original question, are we playing fair at the regulatory process, which is a whole different question than saying, are pesticides being used in the best manner? So I would say, no, they're not being used in the best manner at all. Whether the regulatory process is working, I would say, yeah, it is working. It's working kind of slowly, and it could be improved, but my feeling from talking to everybody and seeing everything, there's a lot of inertia. It's hard to change these things, but it's all going in the right direction. I feel optimistic about the future.
Walter, you said that you had a comment about something
just,
that Randy said?
A minor little fact that everybody should be aware of. BT crops, part of that farming system is actually neonicotinoid seed treatment. There is a joint marketing agreement between Bayer and Monsanto, for example, that requires neonicotinoid seed treatment, because the BT crops, when the plant is small, it doesn't produce enough BT toxin to protect itself. So it's not an either-or. It's part of the overall BT system.
Yeah, I feel that should be changed.
Well, technically, it's the BT system doesn't work without seed treatment. That's the problem.
Yeah. Now, Hank, before you comment, can you share with our listeners a little bit about your own background as a toxicologist working within industry?
Well, yes, since 1985, I've been really involved in industrial toxicology, that is product development in the chemical industry. So I was head of a chief toxicologist in a contract research laboratory in Switzerland for 7 years, and so I've had a lot of dealings with chemical companies in those years, and since 1992, I'm a consultant in toxicology, and I've done a lot of work for the chemical industry. One of the things that strikes me again and again is that people do not realize that the neonicotinoids are a true danger to humanity and to the environment. There's enough evidence to show that we've got all the ingredients here for an environmental disaster. And if we want to avoid an ecological disaster, we need much greater research into the effects of pesticides on bees and beneficial insects, and the requirement that they are tested for their long-term and sublethal effects on pollinators and wildlife before they can be used. We need a rule that chemical companies must publish all of their data and not hide behind commercial sensitivity. Chemical companies often try to pick holes in studies linking their products to bee decline, but when they're pushed to publish their own research and safety studies, they hide behind claims of commercial sensitivity. What have they got to hide? We need tighter regulations and monitoring of pesticides, and we need a publicly available pesticide database and the requirement that farmers and growers report to the database what pesticides they use, how frequently, and in what quantity. Let me say something about independent research. Everybody that was involved in independent studies that linked neonicotinoids to bee decline have had a very hard time. Ever since I published on neonicotinoids, I hardly got any work from chemical companies. So all I'm saying is that we may have to make sure that the independence of research is ascertained and maintained.
Thank you. Before you begin your comment, Tom, I just have a few questions for Hank. First and foremost, you're a toxicologist, correct?
Right.
How often do you work with or do you collaborate with other types of scientists? In other words, as far as the research that you've done on neonicotinoids, do you collaborate with non-PhD researchers that are reviewing your work?
Well, when I publish my work, I always make sure that it is in a peer-reviewed journal.
For our listeners, could you please explain what exactly that means for people that are not familiar with that scientific process?
Well, basically, you submit your manuscript to a journal, and then the editor of the journal gets into contact with a few experienced toxicologists that he thinks are able to judge the quality of the manuscript, and they write up their comments, and the editor sends those comments to you. And he will also evaluate as to whether the publication or the manuscript is suitable for publication. So a lot depends on the judgment of peer reviewers. And it's a good thing when many people look at your work, because you may not be aware of certain aspects that could be very important. So yes, I think peer reviewing is a very good thing.
No, I agree. But what I want to know specifically is the research that is being submitted for review subject to the professional opinions of people who are not toxicologists and have a specialty in other areas, as well as individuals that do not possess the a PhD in that particular area of expertise?
Well, they can try to understand this design, but very often their knowledge may not be sufficient to completely judge the quality of the paper. But it is out in the public. It's been peer-reviewed by experts, and it is in every library, in the scientific library in the world. So everybody can respond to a publication.
Yes, people can respond, but what I'm trying to get at is it common for people that do not possess that proven expertise to review any of the scientific documentation?
It's not very common, but for example, when I published on my discovery on the dose-response characteristics of neonicotinoid insecticide, Bayer responded to experienced toxicologists from Bayer responded and wrote a letter to the editor, to which I could again respond. So we are exchanging views and we are exerting criticism, but it stays in the scientific arena, and everybody can judge for himself.
I agree, but I guess what it boils down to is there are a lot of people who consider themselves to be scientists and experts but don't have the expertise that is basically consists of not only the education, that PhD really does hold a lot of weight, but the experience to go with it, side by side. And I guess what it boils down to is when these papers are peer-reviewed by other toxicologists, do they commonly just reach out to anybody who does not have a PhD in toxicology for their expert opinion as far as whether the research is credible or not?
Well, that would be very uncommon and very unwise for an editor to do, because the quality of his journal depends on peer review and the quality of the manuscripts that are being submitted to the journal.
Thank you. That was exactly my point. And my second question for you is, I know that you have had discussions with some of the scientists that do work in the chemical industry, and they have commented privately off the record about your research. Could you share that with our audience? Because I think that that's something that's very important.
Well, here you have to realize that this subject, this issue of the neonicotinoids is tricky in a sense, because if you express an opinion, you may affect your future prospect in your career. I mean, there's a lot of money involved.
Billions of
dollars. So you better be careful about what you say.
But the
scientists that have spoken to me about my discovery agree that the persistence of the neonicotinoid and their dose response characteristics in our arthropods are an area of great concern. And in fact, even the scientists of Bayer acknowledge that the environmental pollution is a real problem. And they've been trying to do something about it, but we've had it for 10 years in Holland now, and it shows.
Thank you, Henry.
So I hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you. And Tom, do you have a comment?
Yes, I have several comments. I'd like to bring things back down to earth a little bit. I've been a beekeeper. I'm going into my 39th year, and I've lived through the era of these horrible pesticides that Mr. Oliver refers to, and indeed they were. There was a difference, though, between the old families of pesticides and what we're dealing with today. And here in Boulder County, Colorado, we had one of the earliest cooperative programs in the United States with the applicators, and they would call us the night before they applied these pesticides, and we would take steps to protect our bees. Despite that, we still had horrible bee kills in the spring. But given that dramatic setback, those bees were able to recover from that damage and produce a commendable crop of honey. And the reason is we had two things. We had an essentially healthy population of bees, and we had an essentially healthy environment. We have neither of those today. So that's one of the points I'd like to make. The old chemicals are not the end of the world. And in fact, this new family of chemicals, the neonicotinoids, are having the same effect that those old ones did, but not on an acute basis, but long term, year after year. But I'd like to just address some of the things that Mr. Oliver has said, because I'm a little concerned that he presents himself as a scientist, but seems to be eager to either disregard or dismiss the science in favor of his personal observations, his on-the-ground observations that are unsubstantiated by anything other than his own personal comments. And I just want to take a look at a couple of things. The first is he mentions Iowa, and he's said on a number of occasions that everything is just fine out there, that the beekeepers are thriving in Iowa. Well, I asked myself the same question a few months ago, and I thought, well, Iowa is the heartland of these new technologies and should give us an indication of what's happening. So I went to the National Agricultural Statistics Service, and I looked at the colony counts for Iowa over the past 25 years, which covers the introduction of both genetically engineered crops and systemic seed treatments. And what I found, the facts are that the beekeepers are not thriving. And here are the statistics for Iowa. Iowa had 70,000 colonies of bees in the state when genetic engineering entered the scene. In 1994, imidacloprid, the first of the systemic pesticides, came on the market and began to be extensively used in seed treatment on corn and soybeans too. By the year 2000, in the first 6 years after imidacloprid had entered the market, 45% of the colonies in Iowa had disappeared. They'd lost 45% of their colonies. By 2008, fully two-thirds of the Iowa colonies had disappeared. Now, Iowa is interesting because Iowa did not have a large population of commercial beekeepers. So those bees didn't just get relocated to some other state. They disappeared. I wouldn't call that thriving. But let's look at a little broader aspect of that picture, and that would be the national honey production. Before we entered this era, before we encountered these problems, the national honey production, the national honey crop, would have been in the neighborhood of 230 to 240 million pounds a year. This year, the 2013 honey crop is estimated to be 125 million pounds or less, and many believe that it may be as low as 95 million pounds. I would hardly call that thriving.
Thriving.
We are faced with perhaps the most significant environmental disaster of our time.
That's
and
correct.
The evidence is clear.
The evidence is really clear, and I don't know why people are hesitating, why the regulators are hesitating. if they've got any sense in their mind, they must ban these compounds because they're creating an ecological disaster that will also affect us, humanity. We cannot survive without nature, and if we destroy nature, we destroy ourselves.
Tom, do you have any more comments?
No, I don't. I think that covers what I wanted to address.
Okay, we're going to move on to the last set of questions in this interview, which is it's going to be a little bit long. The clip is a little bit longer, so folks, bear with us. But here we go.
What should the registration process for a neonicotinoid consist of?
Exactly where it's going with the new regulation for 2014. They need to look at all the routes of exposure. They need to also test on. Right now, you test on humans, you test on a bird such as quail, you test on a fish such as a rainbow trout, you test on rats for a mammal, and they test on honeybee for insects. Now, they don't test on other bee species. Now, there's I've read every bit of research, every study, everything that Walter's read. I'm familiar with all of those, and also with research that has not been published yet. We're finding out that different species of insects react differently to the neonicotinoids, and this is going to be a huge thing coming out. So when you ask about honeybees, I can answer for honeybees. But honeybees are not the only concern. There's also bumblebees. There's leafcutter bees. There's the ground nesting bees. Different species react differently to each different pesticide, and we focus tremendously on the neonicotinoids of late to the exclusion of focusing on the impacts of other pesticides. And I think that's a big problem that we're doing right now. There was recently a paper came out from Italy where they found that the herbicide paraquat, that isn't even looked at in pesticide screens, they found that at parts per trillion concentrations, it had effects on the immune system of the honeybee. Well, parts per trillion you can't even measure. You have to dilute it to that. In our single-minded looking at the neonicotinoids, I think that we are probably missing problems that are happening with other pesticides. So I'd like to shift this focus to back to an overall look at re-looking at all pesticide registrations and not just simply focus on the neonicotinoids. And what it does is the focus on one particular thing draws the attention of the environmental community away from the bigger picture, the larger picture. And the larger picture is we need to look at our entire agricultural landscape. our move towards monoculture is devastating to the environment. The wildlife is having a really hard time. Luckily, and I'm probably going back to your last question, is where we can go. And Walter, I'm sure and I will probably be in 100% agreement on this. I saw a really good presentation by a guy from Pheasants Forever at a recent bee conference, and he showed all these win-win situations where landowners, hunters, wildlife managers, naturalists, bird watchers all win, and pollinators all win by simply reconfiguring the agricultural landscape away from this massive high herbicide monoculture that we're using right now. His presentation didn't mention neonicotinoids at all, and that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking for a bigger picture than focusing on one little thing, and for us to get away from this distraction and look at that we really need as humans. We're really putting a huge impact on the environment right now, and the agricultural lands are a major part of that. Currently, in many of the agricultural lands, it's hard for a honeybee or for any insect to make a living. They're just disappearing because there's not enough food, because we use every square foot for growing single crops, and we don't allow a single weed to grow there. So now you have square miles that don't have anything for insects to eat, for pollinators to eat, for more than just like the 2 weeks that they bloom. So that would be my two bits right there.
Randy, I just want you to clarify something in regards to, I appreciate everything that you said, but I just would like you to clarify, in regards to the registration process, do you feel that the tests, as you mentioned, on the different species should take place and it should be the full registration or the full testing process and so on and so forth before registration is granted to a particular chemical, whether it be a neonicotinoid, what have you?
Yes, I do. And up to this point, that just wasn't out there on the table. Now it's coming to the table, and the new processes will incorporate those. Now, it takes a while to make these changes. So, yeah, we could change those that risk assessment starting with 2014, but it takes years to go through now all the insecticides, for the test to be run on those. So, yeah, there's going to be an inertia, and it's going to be frustrating. I mean, I'd love to have it all happen tomorrow, but it's not going to all happen tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Because my concern was with the registration process for clothianidin. From what I understand, it was granted registration, but it has not necessarily gone through that full process as you described, which really does make sense.
Well, here's the deal. The full process can take a long time, and with the EPA, at least, when they register, they do their risk assessment and they release a pesticide, they're fully aware that there's no way you can predict everything that could possibly go wrong with something. So then you release the pesticide out there and let it be used with the full intent that they're going to monitor it carefully and look for adverse effects reports and for things that they hadn't foreseen. And then what they do, if there is an adverse effect, if they're serious, they can restrict the registration right then, or they can ask the registrant to do more studies, and they're doing that right now. I mean, I know that Bayer and Syngenta are doing a ton of these studies, looking at citrus. They're doing studies on corn, on soybeans, for that very reason, because the EPA says, oh, man, we may have overlooked that or didn't realize that we should be looking at that. So this process is taking place right now.
Thank you. I just think that they should, instead of granting the registration and then monitoring for things that they haven't thought of, they should go through the full process to basically
How do you do something that you haven't thought of? How do you design a test for something you've never thought of?
Tell you what the Europeans, how they're going about this, you know?
Yes, please.
First of all, I agree with Randy's points that just overly focusing on the neonicotinoids is not going to get us very far. I don't view the neonicotinoids as a distraction, and neither do the regulators in Europe. Neonicotinoids have been on the market for a long time. For some applications, they're actually at the end of the life cycle. You have resistance of pests in several states in the U.S. on several crops already. And the business model of the chemical companies actually relies on the products at the end of their life cycle either no longer being effective because of resistance of the pests, or having a ban of the products, because otherwise generic manufacturers can crank out these products cheaply and there's no space in the market for their next patented products. So what is important is that at least the European regulators are looking at the neonicotinoids as a learning experience, where they said, okay, at least in Europe, they were registered based on all the tests that were required at that time, and they're looking at what happened here now as at least a partial failure of the old approval process. And that's why there is a guidance document being proposed right now, where the risk assessment is going to be done differently. And part of this is even obvious in the title, because this risk assessment guidance document talks about honeybees, but also about bumblebees and solitary bees. So because now it is very clear that not just honeybees are a protection goal, but the other pollinators are a protection goal as well, you can decide to conduct certain tests with the species that is where you can most easily demonstrate whether there is a problem or not. The honeybees turn out to be a bit of a problem for the scientists trying to design the tests for approval, because honeybee colonies are extremely complex, and it is also very difficult to have a controlled environment. One of the problems that a lot of these studies had is if neonicotinoids are extremely widely used, where are you going to come up with a neonicotinoid-free control for your field experiment? So the other species are going to help streamline the approval process. One thing that came out in a symposium, a scientific symposium that happened here in Germany, is that a lot of the researchers are running in a situation where if you conduct a short-term experiment, it looks like problems that you can clearly demonstrate are affecting individual bees don't appear to be translating into problems at the colony level, because the colony is essentially able to buffer. But then if you run the experiment further, you find that there's a price for this buffering, and there is a point where something that looked like it was completely on track and normally suddenly collapses. And so they're right now in the process of trying to figure out how you can take this information and design tests for the registration process in a way that can be standardized. And one point where I'm not quite as optimistic as Randy is about where these where the overhaul of the registration process is headed, is I've been in many meetings where I was observing how the representatives of the chemical companies deal with this, and essentially, these complexities always provide an excuse to do more research, to delay action, which means that the old registration, the old flawed registration process, remains in place. And where we need to get to is to start instituting some of these tests, even if they're not perfect yet. Instead of using this test issue to delay instituting improved tests at all.
Thank you. Randy, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, Walter hit the nail on the head with the registration process. It takes quite a few years for a company to develop and register a chemical. And if it's on patent, then they only have maybe 7 to 10 years to recoup all their investment. So they're under incredible pressure to try to get it out on the market as quickly as possible before it either goes off patent or, as Walter says, before the insects develop resistance to it. And with the incredibly widespread use of some of the neonics, we're going to see resistance develop pretty quickly, and they will have to move on to something else. So that's something that will happen. The other thing, and again, the point was very good, these honeybee colonies have this tremendous buffering capacity. You can feed a honeybee colony very high levels of the tested clothianidin or imidacloprid for very long periods of time, and you just don't see an effect. Now, if you make a smaller colony, the smaller the colony, the more you see the effect. So when are we talking about theory or real life here? So that's what I'm saying. I like to go out on the ground and actually feed beekeepers who are keeping their colonies alive year after year after year, and not just keeping them alive, but they're making money on them and they're producing honey with them. So
well, but you see an effect.
Yeah.
The thing is, what the researchers concluded is, if you a lot of the studies that don't see effect are simply too short because you're essentially in the buffering phase of the colony. But at some point, you're running out of buffer, and then you have a rapid collapse.
And this is what I'm saying. With the beekeepers who are keeping bees year after year after year after year, there would be no running out of buffer. These guys are doing it. They're living in it. They're living in it year after year, and they're not seeing this happen in real life. So when you talk about lab studies, it's one thing. When you talk about real life studies, and this has been the thing that, you know, I follow all the science, but I also get my feet out on the ground and go out and visit beekeepers and look at what's actually happening in the real world. And I have to weigh those two. I mean, what I see with my own eyes. If that does not support what the science is saying might happen, then I'm saying, well, God, it looks like maybe it's not happening.
Randy, I think you have it slightly backwards, because the science, the new round of research, happened after the beekeepers observed problems in the field and pointed to the neonicotinoids. We actually had a research project in Austria, where they didn't follow the German lead of the partial ban, because industry said, well, we're going to improve the seed treatments, the quality of the coating, we're going to improve the equipment, we're going to install filters and deal with the dust problem. And the Austrian government said, okay, fine, we let you do that, but we are going to monitor whether this actually works. And so they funded the Melissa project. And what happened was, I talked to the chief scientist that was doing the monitoring, and the Melissa project was, if a beekeeper saw a problem that he thought was related to pesticides, a group of scientists went out and basically did the complete post-mortem. And he said in his scientific career, he had never seen such a high correlation between beekeepers saying, I think I've got a pesticide problem here, and them being able to confirm that. So the beekeepers, at least that I represent here in Europe, they are up in arms because they're seeing this. Some of them are taking evasive action and are leaving certain areas that they used to produce honey in to protect their bees. But at least the beekeepers that, and you know, I'm a beekeeper myself, that that I'm dealing with have quite a different view. And that's why also, you know, beekeeping organizations, there's rivalries, there's, you know, squabbles. I have never seen the beekeeping community so united around a cause, because they're all seeing that this is a real issue, not just something that happens in a lab.
Yeah, in the United States, there are people who are adamantly convinced also, and there's people who vote Republican, there's people who vote Democrat, and they feel very strongly about that. I just, all I'm telling is what I see with my own eyes. I've talked to the presidents of the state associations, beekeeper associations, in all the corn states to ask them what they're seeing. I've talked to the local people. I've visited them. And, so we have a different experience here
than what you're
seeing there. Now, and as you say, Walter, it's very, very complicated. There's a lot of stuff happening in beehives these days, and pesticides certainly are a part of that, especially the beekeeper-applied pesticides to control the varroa mite. So it's a very complex thing, and I don't think that there are really simple answers on it. As much as I would love to have simple answers, I caution on that, and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The 3-year restriction in Europe, whether we actually see an improvement in bee health over there. Right now, I can tell you that the beekeepers in the American Corn Belt, if they care for their colonies properly, they don't need an improvement in bee health, because the bees appear to be doing very well there.
Well, it's actually a point that you raised with the beekeeper-applied chemicals. this was a point that I made to representatives of the chemical industry, because some of them are actually have divisions that are selling products to control the varroa mite. And I don't think some of these products are it's in their best interest to market them, because they actually have synergistic effects with the pesticides they are marketing. And it would be much smarter to go on the varroa side to things like organic acids that have a completely different mode of action, and where they're not exacerbating the problem with the varroa sites that they're selling.
I'm in complete agreement with you. I've only used natural treatments for 14 years now in my operation. I run successful commercial beekeeping operations with no synthetic miticides. So, yeah, you're preaching to the choir to me.
Yeah, well, at least Bayer actually listened. I can send you and all the listeners where maybe June can post it. In the middle of this neonicotinoid battle, I managed to compartmentalize things and work on a research project with them to do the mode of action research on formic acid, because that is, I think beekeepers should do whatever they can to keep their bees healthy, and I'll accept support from anybody that is willing to do that. But at the same time, the chemical companies need to take responsibility for the products that they're selling and work on their end of the equation.
I agree. Hey, one thing I'd like to, June, before we end.
Sure.
One of the things I've been asking with the EPA trying to do is to set up sentinel apiaries throughout the agriculture areas of the United States, where you put out hives, you have them professionally managed to make sure that they're managed properly to control parasites, and then to see whether they can indeed survive in those agricultural areas. The problem is it falls between everybody's jurisdictions. I've spoken with the head of the U.S. Agricultural Research Service. I spoke with the head risk assessor for EPA. Everybody says, well, that's not in our purview to do that. That would have to be U.S. Geological Service or something. And they're not interested. If somebody right now donated $1 million for bee research, I would use it to set up sentinel apiaries throughout agriculture areas all over the United States, and Europe would be great also. And that would be the final proof. If you can't keep honeybee colonies alive, and I would also put an acre of natural forage in each one of these places so you look at the native species, and that would tell us, that would be the absolute on-the-ground proof. If in an agriculture area, if you set aside an acre of natural area untreated with pesticides and allow the insects to forage in the agricultural area, whether those species can survive there year after year. And if they can, then we're doing a successful agricultural system. If they can't, then that would tell our regulators we are failing at being able to keep the natural wildlife alive in our agricultural systems, and there's something that we need to change. So if I had my dream come true, I would set that up immediately.
Walter, any last comments?
Well, some of these comparative studies that are going in the direction that you mentioned, Randy, have been done, and it basically shows that the best place to keep bees right now is cities, because of the diversity of foraging opportunities in parks and trees that line the streets and so forth, and limited pesticide use. So pesticides are only one part of the equation. Intensive agriculture overall creates an environment that is hostile to bees and
very much so.
Native pollinators, and we need to work on changing that paradigm.
I am in complete agreement with you.
All right. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, gentlemen. Hank, could you please comment, and also can you explain for our listeners a little bit about the sublethal effects of neonicotinoids that you have discovered in your research?
First of all, I just wondered about the beekeepers that Miss Oliver has been talking to. He hasn't certainly talked to the French beekeepers who brought up the neonicotinoid issue in the 1990s. He hasn't probably talked to the beekeepers of Ontario. I mean, there is a real problem with bees at the moment. And I'm under the impression that Mr. Oliver is trying to massage the problem. As to sublethal effects, well, the neonicotinoid insecticides interact with the nervous system, with receptors, as we call them, that play important roles in cognition. So whenever poisoning with neonicotinoids occurs, the bees have difficulties in navigating and foraging. Also, we assume that they become more susceptible to disease. So while it is true that that the parasites play an important role in bee decline, it is really because the bees are being weakened by neonicotinoid insecticides.
The reason that I wanted you to touch upon that is because based upon that very information, and Tom, you can elaborate on this in a moment, but what is the point of having a small patch of land for foraging if the sublethal effects are just as you stated? It's not going to matter.
It's not going to matter at all. If you know the toxicology of neonicotinoids and the fact that they pollute the environment and that they're very persistent in that environment, then you know that a lot of non-target insects are going to be exposed to these chemicals for a very long time. And what I've shown in 2010 is that the dose response characteristics of these pesticides are such that the toxicity is reinforced by thyme. So you need very small quantities to eventually kill bees within their lifetime.
Thank you. And Tom, would you like to comment?
Yes, I would. Here in the United States, the gatekeeper is the Environmental Protection Agency. Those are the people that we rely upon to represent the interests of both the people and the environment. And in fact, their basic charge is the protection of mankind and the environment against unreasonable risk. And they've failed to do so. And I'd like to just expand a little bit on one of the suggestions that Mr. Oliver made, which is that we have sentinel apiaries, and we plant an acre of natural forage. And it reminds me of a study called the Cutler-Dupree study that was misused, to get clothianidin on the market in 2003. EPA scientists wanted a life cycle study conducted prior to the registration of this product. Because of the experience in France, they were concerned about the effects on the pollinators, and they were overridden apparently by management and were forced to agree with a conditional registration. The condition was what's called the Cutler-Dupree study. Those were the researchers, and it was supposed to have been completed in the first growing season, but it languished for several years, was finally completed, and in 2010, the EPA scientists reviewed it again and concluded that it was basically of no value. It was invalid and required that the Bayer, the owner of this product, do it again, which they have done to the tune of about $1 million, yet to be released. We still don't know. But the original Cutler-Dupree study consisted of four colonies of bees on 4 acres of treated seed, surrounded by thousands and thousands of acres of untreated seed, and they concluded, no problem. I find it interesting that Mr. Oliver suggests these sentinel apiaries. It seems to me to be more than a little disingenuous and diversionary. We've had sentinel apiaries It's called American beekeeping. And the experience is we've lost something on the order of 10 million colonies of bees in the last 10 or 15 years. The EPA still has yet to do anything with respect to clothianidin. It's been on the market. We're going into our 11th growing season. It's used on hundreds of millions of acres. And rather than take any steps to control this damage, they've done things like in September of 2012, they approved clothianidin as a seed treatment and foliar application on rice. Now, here we have a product that's water-soluble, migrates readily with the groundwater. Tiny, tiny amounts can have profound effects. As little as a tenth of a part per billion can be lethal over time for a colony of bees. So their decision is to just approve it to put right in the water. The regulatory system has failed. We have, and I think Hank would agree, we have what may be the greatest environmental disaster of our time. And the EPA and the rest of these people are looking for excuses rather than answers.
Well, that's completely correct, Tom. And the frightening thing is that even if we ban these compounds today, they'll be in the environment for decades, and they'll be killing insects, non-target insects. So, in fact, we time is running out. We have to act now.
Thank you.
It may already be too late.
I have a quick question for you, Tom. I have conducted a number of interviews with some of the biggest commercial beekeepers here in America, namely Jeff Anderson, Darren Cox, just to name a few off the top of my head. Now, if they're losing a substantial amount of bees, what is the point of creating these sentinel or having these sentinel beekeepers when we're already seeing what is happening to what I would consider expert beekeepers? I mean, you're talking about multi-generation beekeepers. It almost insinuates that the commercial beekeepers who have been doing this for multi-generations are not doing it right, which makes no sense.
Well, the point is to drag it out further, to confuse the issue.
That's right.
To delay any action, it's a diversionary step. We don't need sentinel apiaries. We've had sentinel apiaries. I talked earlier about what's happened in Iowa over the past 15 or 20 years. There are your sentinel apiaries.
Thank you. And Hank, Tom, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today and for sharing your opinions with our audience. So, you know, it's been great listening to both of you, and folks, also for all of you that have been listening to just the clips. I know it's been a long segment, but this is kind of an interesting way where we can get different bee advocates and experts such as Dr. Tanaki's on the show and share their expertise. So, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
I'd like to thank the listeners who've stuck with us to the end. You know, these are difficult questions, and it's not easy to understand and educate yourself. And for those of the listeners who are still with us, thank you, and stay tuned, because we're going to have to speak about this much, much more.
I agree with that, Tom.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. And please visit our website, www.theorganicbee.com, where if you look, we have an assortment of different offers from our sponsors, as well as if you've missed a show, you can go to our show archives and also catch up. Thank you, everybody. Have a great afternoon.